conclusively demonstrated that by using filters to exclude dust particles, he could prevent mould from growing in boiled broth. This convinced most Europeans that moulds did not grow spontaneously, but required to be seeded by germs from the air, and so the germ theory began to take hold. Then the British surgeon Joseph Lister, hearing of Pasteur's experiments, put two and two together and realized that airborne germs must be responsible for the wound infections, which killed around half of those undergoing surgery. Lister pioneered strict antiseptic surgical techniques, and in 1871 he invented a carbolic acid spray intended to kill germs in his operating theatre. Using this, he virtually overcame the wound sepsis problem in his surgical units at Glasgow and Edinburgh. And thanks to his methods, German doctors were able to save the lives of hundreds of soldiers wounded in the Franco-Prussian War. Despite these successes, most surgeons in the UK and the US were still opposed to the new ideas. But by the 1880s, after Robert Koch had demonstrated that the use of steam to sterilize surgical instruments also reduced wound sepsis, and Lister had successfully carried out complex surgical procedures under full antiseptic cover, the doubters were gradually convinced, and surgery became a much safer procedure. The golden age of bacteriology began in 1877 when Koch isolated the anthrax bacillus, the cause of the zoonotic disease anthrax. There followed a spate of microbe discoveries, so that by the end of the 19th century, those causing diphtheria, typhoid, leprosy, pneumonia, gonorrhea, plague, tetanus, and syphilis had all been identified. Koch himself isolated the tuberculosis bacillus in 1882 and the cholera vibrio in 1883. He established strict scientific criteria for linking a microbe to a disease, which are now known as Koch's postulates. To prove a causative association, the microbe must be found in the body in all cases of the disease, isolated from the case and grown and maintained in a pure culture, capable of reproducing the disease when the pure culture is inoculated into a susceptible animal, retrieved from an inoculated animal. Those opposed to the germ theory fought it for some time, but were soon overcome by the sheer weight of experimental evidence, and it was generally accepted by the beginning of the 20th century. Koch was awarded a Nobel Prize for his work on tuberculosis in 1905. But there were still many common infectious diseases, such as smallpox, measles, mumps, rubella, and flu, for which no microbe could be found, and their cause remained a mystery. Called filterable agents, because the infectivity passed through filters that retained bacteria, at the time, most people believed that they would just turn out to be very small bacteria. But with the invention of the electron microscope in 1932, it was obvious that these infections were caused by a very different type of microbe, a virus. The history of our struggle against the smallpox virus is worth following as a unique journey from ancient beliefs and superstitions to the triumph of complete global eradication. In the towns and cities of our oldest civilizations, smallpox was a disease that could not be ignored. It regularly swept through like a giant wave, killing up to a third of those infected and scarring, blinding or otherwise maiming many of the survivors. In many civilizations, this much-feared killer had its own god, like the Chinese god Tu Shen Nyang Nyang and the Indian folk goddess Shitala, to whom the people prayed and made offerings in the hope of being spared or cured. In AD 450, the Bishop of Reims, later canonized as Saint Nicaise, patron saint of smallpox victims, survived a smallpox epidemic brought to France by the marauding Huns, only to be beheaded by these eastern invaders a year later on the steps of his own cathedral. He can still be seen there today, carved in stone, standing above the north door, holding his mitred head in his hands. Smallpox was first distinguished from measles by the Persian physician Al-Razi, Razes, circa 865 to 925 or 932, chief of the hospital in Baghdad in his treatise on the smallpox and measles. However, Al-Razi's main claim to fame was the heat treatment, which he advocated for smallpox, and which was faithfully followed by many well-meaning doctors until the 17th century, much to the detriment of their unfortunate patients. He and his followers believed that smallpox resulted from fermentation of the blood, and the humours this produced escaped through pores in the skin. In an attempt to assist this process, the heat treatment confined sufferers to a room with a blazing fire and sealed windows to sweat out the offending humours. And throughout Europe from the 12th century onwards, this was supplemented with the red treatment, which condemned smallpox victims to be dressed in red clothes, wrapped in red blankets, confined to rooms hung with red drapes, and attended only by people dressed in red. This was thought to reduce scarring from the pox and was religiously applied to all royal smallpox sufferers. See Chapter 4. In the 14th century, Charles V of France was dressed in red shirt and stockings and wore a red veil. He survived, but nearly 400 years later, the great Habsburg Emperor, Joseph I, who was swaddled in 20 yards of red cloth, was not so fortunate. His death cost Austria the Spanish throne. This bizarre practice of erythrotherapy probably originated in Japan, where, according to folklore, red is the colour for expelling demons and illness. But despite being discredited in the early 1900s, it was not completely abandoned until the 1930s. With the additional application of leeches, a widespread treatment to bleed out a fever, it is not surprising that people who could afford smallpox treatment died more frequently than those who could not. But all this changed in the mid-17th century when the English physician Sir Thomas Sydenham noticed the increased smallpox mortality among the rich and linked it to the treatment they received. He improved survival by advocating no treatment for milder cases, declaring that they would recover unaided, and introducing a cooling treatment for the more lethal confluent smallpox, with windows flung open to dispel the evil humours. Smallpox inoculation. Inoculation against smallpox was going on in both China and India for hundreds of years before it was brought to the West, and since different methods were used, the practice almost certainly arose independently in each of these countries. The technique of inoculation, also called variolation or engrafting, is first mentioned in Chinese medical books dating from AD 1500, but it had probably been practiced there from around AD 1000. According to legend, the technique was introduced by a reclusive nun who lived in a reed hut on the top of the sacred Omei mountain. She claimed to be the incarnation of the goddess of mercy, come to preserve the lives of children by implanting smallpox, which she did by preparing a powder from dried scabs and blowing it up the child's nose, left nostril for a girl, right for a boy, through a silver tube. 6 days later, the child came down with a fever and developed pox, but most recovered and were then immune from smallpox for life. As the practice spread throughout the region, the nun attracted quite a following, and after her death she was worshipped locally as the goddess of smallpox. The Indian technique, Use needles dipped in pus taken from smallpox pustules to puncture the skin at several sites on the upper arm or forehead, and the small wounds were then covered with a paste made from boiled rice. As trade routes from India opened up, this practice spread to Southwest Asia and into parts of Central Europe and Africa, reaching Constantinople towards the end of the 17th century. It was here that Lady Mary Wortley Montagu discovered inoculation, introducing it to Britain and eventually to the rest of Europe and the US. Several years before Lady Mary's discovery, reports of inoculation reached the Royal Society in London. Indeed, the Chinese intranasal method was reported twice in 1700, and then in 1714 and 1716. Papers describing the Turkish practice were delivered by physicians who had seen it for themselves, but these reports were universally ignored. Lady Mary, née Pierpont, daughter of the first Duke of Kingston, seemed to have everything— intellect, beauty, great riches, and a social standing bestowed by her father's dukedom and her husband's parliamentary position. She must have grown up under the spectre of smallpox as she lived in London during the height of its deadly power, and shortly after her marriage to Edward Wortley Montagu, MP, in 1712, her beloved brother, Will, died of the disease. Then, in 1714, just after the birth of her son Edward, she herself contracted smallpox. And although she recovered and her baby son remained well, her beautiful face was scarred and her eyelashes gone forever. This, then, was the situation when Edward Wortley Montagu was appointed British ambassador to the Ottoman Empire— and the whole family, plus a large entourage, including their personal physician, Dr. Charles Maitland, left for Constantinople, now Istanbul, in 1716. With her recent personal experiences of smallpox, it is not surprising that Lady Mary was receptive to any means of protecting her child, so when she heard of the practice of inoculation, she was keen to investigate further. After just a few weeks in Constantinople, she wrote to her friend, Sarah Chiswell. "The smallpox, so fatal and so general among us, is here entirely harmless by the invention of ingrafting, which is the term they give it. There is a set of old women who make it their business to perform the operation every autumn in the month of September when the great heat has abated. People send to one another to know if any of their family has a mind to have the smallpox. They make parties for this purpose, and when they are met, commonly 15 or 16 together, the old woman comes with a nutshell full of the matter of the best sort of smallpox, and asks what vein you please to have opened. She immediately rips open that you offer her with a large needle, which gives you no more pain than a common scratch, and puts into the vein as much of the matter as can lie upon the head of her needle, and after that binds up the little wound with a hollow bit of shell, and in this manner opens up 4 or 5 veins. The children or young patients play together all the rest of the day, and are in perfect health to the 8th. Then the fever begins to seize them, and they keep their beds 2 days, very seldom 3. They have very rarely above 20 or 30 pox on their faces, which never mark, and in 8 days they are as well as before their illness. Dr. Charles Maitland learnt the procedure from an old Greek woman, and in 1718 he inoculated 5-year-old Edward on both arms. It was a complete success. After 7 to 8 days, the child developed a fever and around 100 pox, but they all healed without scarring. The family was back in London again by 1721, when a severe smallpox epidemic broke out, and Lady Mary persuaded Dr. Maitland to inoculate her 4-year-old daughter, Mary. This time, 2 eminent physicians attended as eyewitnesses, one of whom was the influential Sir Hans Sloane, president of the Royal Society and the King's physician. The inoculation was a success, and soon Caroline, Princess of Wales, was keen for her two daughters to be inoculated, but not before the procedure was tested on others. Six condemned criminals from Newgate Prison were bribed with the offer of freedom if their inoculations were successful, and after Maitland had performed the task, all six prisoners were released. They were probably already immune to smallpox anyway. When further tests on orphans from the parish of St. James in London were also uneventful, King George I gave consent for his granddaughters to be inoculated. The success of these high-profile inoculations did much to popularize the procedure in Britain. But inoculation had its opponents. Many medical practitioners were genuinely concerned about the danger of full-blown smallpox, which could result directly from inoculation or by spread of the virus from recently inoculated subjects to the non-immune. However, some were more concerned about their loss of revenue from smallpox cases, and others were just inherently prejudiced against such foreign practices. The words of Dr. William Wagstaff, physician at St. Bartholomew's Hospital in London and fellow of the Royal College of Physicians and of the Royal Society, sum up the attitude common at the time. Posterity will scarcely be brought to believe that a method practiced only by a few ignorant women amongst an illiterate and unthinking people should on a sudden and upon a slender experience so far obtain in one of the most learned and polite nations in the world as to be received into the royal palace. Religious arguments were also strongly voiced and were fueled by the first highly publicized deaths from full-blown smallpox following inoculation. The views expressed by the Reverend Edmund Massey in a sermon preached in 1722 at St. Andrew's Church, Holborn, were typical of those arguing against the dangerous practice because inoculation opposes the will of God who sends disease, including smallpox, either to try our faith or to punish us for sins. Lady Mary was eloquent in refuting all argument, and many eminent medical men supported her. One such, James Durin, presented a paper to the Royal Society in 1723, comparing the risk of inoculation with that of natural smallpox, and showing that in the recent epidemic, one in five or six smallpox victims died, whereas only one out of 91 died after inoculation. After this, inoculation became an accepted practice in Britain and successfully protected people from smallpox until it was superseded by a different and safer procedure called vaccination in the early 19th century. However, the practice was slower to catch on in Europe, particularly in France, where medical prejudices and religious objections held sway for much longer than in Britain. Smallpox vaccination. Despite the popularization of inoculation in Britain, its uptake was patchy. In rural areas where many villagers reach adulthood without ever being exposed to smallpox, and an epidemic could therefore potentially carry off all the younger generation, inoculation was welcomed with enthusiasm. In contrast, in large cities like London, where smallpox was endemic, it was an accepted threat to children from poor families, and no one thought it worth preventing. So smallpox continued to take its toll throughout the 18th century. Edward Jenner, 1749 to 1823, grew up in the town of Berkeley in Gloucestershire, England, and after his medical training at St. George's Hospital, London, returned there in 1773 to indulge his two interests of medicine and natural history. Interestingly, he was elected Fellow of the Royal Society not for his work on smallpox, but for his discovery that the cuckoo lays her eggs in the nests of other birds, and that once hatched, the young parasite takes full advantage of its adoptive parents by ejecting their natural offspring. Be that as it may, his name is immortalized for his later pioneering work on smallpox vaccination, a unique form of preventive medicine that has saved countless millions of lives. Living in the country, Jenna had heard the traditional tales about cowpox infection protecting people from smallpox and set out to investigate. Cowpox is a natural skin infection of cattle that causes blisters on cows' udders. It can spread directly to humans and consequently usually affects the hands of milkers. In his practice, Jenner often performed inoculations, and he saw for himself that cowpoxed milkers did not develop pox after inoculation, seeming to be already immune. This led him, in 1796, to his famous and infamous experiment on young James Phipps, inoculating him with cowpox from a pock on the hand of a milkmaid, Sarah Nelms. The boy developed a mild case of cowpox, but when 6 weeks later Jenna inoculated him with pus from a natural case of smallpox, he remained healthy, indicating that he was immune. In a letter to a friend, Jenna wrote, "I was astonished at the close resemblance of the pustules in some of their stages to the variolous pustules. But now listen to the most delightful part of my story. The boy has since been inoculated for the smallpox, which, as I ventured to predict, produced no effect. I shall pursue my experiments with redoubled ardour." And he did. With the next cowpox outbreak in 1798, he inoculated 5 more children, 3 of whom he challenged with natural smallpox, and all were immune. In the same year, he announced his results in a pamphlet entitled, "An Inquiry into the Causes and Effects of Variolae Vaccinae, a Disease Discovered in Some of the Western Counties of England, particularly Gloucestershire, and known by the name of cowpox." His discovery was soon verified by others and shown to be much safer than inoculation. And Jenner's demonstration that vaccine material could be obtained from pox of vaccinated children meant that a chain of arm-to-arm vaccinations could be set up without constant recourse to a milkmaid or cow with the pox. With this method of propagation, the practice of vaccination rapidly spread throughout the UK, to Europe, and then around the world. Indeed, in 1803, Charles IV of Spain, who had lost a child of his own to smallpox, sponsored the Balmes-Salvini expedition, named after the doctors who led it, to take vaccination to the Spanish-American colonies. They set sail from the Spanish port of La Corona, with 21 orphans from the local orphanage on board to keep the vaccine alive during the voyage by forming a chain of arm-to-arm vaccinations. By 1801, over 100,000 people in the UK had been vaccinated, and its impact was dramatic. Smallpox deaths in London fell from 91.7 per thousand deaths in the late 18th century to 51.7 between 1801 to 1825, and to 14.3 between 1851 to 1875. In Sweden, where vaccination was widespread and compulsory from 1816 onwards, the total number of smallpox deaths dropped from 12,000 in 1801 to just 11 in 1822, and during the same period, average life expectancy rose from 35 to 40 years for men and 38 to 44 for women. Although there were those who objected to vaccination on religious grounds, believing that it was interfering with the will of God, the relative ease of acceptance of the practice was thanks to the battles fought over its forerunner, inoculation, which it now replaced as a safer option. Jenner's fame was legendary even in his lifetime, and 80 years after his death, the French microbiologist Louis Pasteur, in his honour, coined the term vaccination for all inoculations against infectious diseases, saying in his address to an international medical congress in London in 1881, "I have given to the term vaccination an extension which science, I hope, will consecrate as a homage to the merit of and to the immense services rendered by one of the greatest Englishmen, your Jenner. I am indeed happy to be able to praise this immortal name in the noble and hospitable city of London. The term is still used today." In his 1801 pamphlet, The Origins of the Vaccine Inoculation, Edward Jenner himself suggested that the annihilation of the smallpox, the most dreadful scourge of the human species, must be the final result of this practice. He was right, although there were many hurdles to overcome before this could be accomplished. Arm-to-arm vaccination was cumbersome, often led to supply problems, and was soon found to spread diseases, particularly syphilis. One alarming incident occurred in Rivalta, Italy, in 1814, when 63 children were unwittingly vaccinated with material from an apparently healthy infant who was suffering from congenital syphilis. 44 of the vaccinees developed syphilis. Several died, and others passed it on to their mothers and nurses. These problems were eventually overcome when regular supplies of vaccine were obtained from calves inoculated with cowpox at multiple sites on the flank, and this prepared the way for large-scale production of a standardized product. Another problem became apparent when, around 20 years after vaccination was introduced, smallpox reappeared in Europe. Although death rates were low compared with the ravages of the 18th century, now the pattern of the epidemics had changed, with adults bearing the brunt of the infection, while children, who had been recently vaccinated, were spared. And so it became clear that vaccination did not give lifelong protection, and revaccination would be required at intervals throughout life. By 1896, the 100th anniversary of Jenner's discovery, a successful vaccination strategy had been worked out, and global eradication could be contemplated, although the nature of the infectious agent was still unknown. The World Health Organization, WHO, announced its worldwide smallpox eradication campaign in 1966, by which time the virus had already been eliminated from Europe and the US, but was still endemic in 31 countries forming four major blocs: South America, Indonesia, Sub-Saharan Africa, and the Indian subcontinent. The WHO team, headed by Don Henderson, seconded from the Center for Disease Control, Atlanta, USA, argued that since the virus has no human or animal reservoir, interrupting the chain of infection was key to its worldwide elimination. Their attack was three-pronged: maintain vaccination rates at over 80%, isolate cases to prevent spread, and trace and isolate contacts. This was so successful that they achieved their goal in 10 years and finally celebrated a world free of smallpox in 1980, less than 200 years after Jenner set the train in motion by vaccinating James Phipps, a disease that had killed over 300 million in the 20th century alone, was no more. There is no doubt that the world would be a safer place without the smallpox virus, but instead of completely destroying stocks at the end of the eradication campaign, the virus was stored at the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, Atlanta, and the Research Institute for Viral Preparations in Moscow. These stocks were due to be destroyed at the end of the 20th century, but when D-Day arrived, the decision was postponed by those who suggested that the virus might be a valuable research tool in the future, and by conservationists who could not countenance the deliberate elimination of any living species. While the argument raged on, the monumental events in the U.S. of 9/11, followed by the anthrax bioterrorist attack in October and November 2001, completely changed the goalposts. Now everyone admits that bioterrorism is a real threat, and smallpox is right up there with anthrax and botulinal toxin as one of the most effective weapons. As vaccinations ceased shortly after its eradication, most of the world's population is now susceptible to the smallpox virus, and stockpiles of vaccine are woefully inadequate. The virus is stable, remaining active for long periods. It is easy to grow up in bulk and spreads through the air. What more could a terrorist group ask for? And no one really knows how much virus there is out there and whose hands it has fallen into. In the 1980s, it was rumored that Russian military scientists were making even more lethal viruses, such as a smallpox-Ebola hybrid. And with the breakup of the USSR in the 1990s, these scientists dispersed to other countries, perhaps taking the virus with them. When the U.S. government decided to vaccinate at-risk groups in preparation for a possible bioterrorist attack, the side effects of the vaccine, particularly cardiac problems, were unacceptably high compared with the perceived threat. So at the moment, those who advocate hanging on to the virus have won the day. Research into safer vaccines and antiviral drugs is underway, and there is no saying when, if ever, the virus will be completely destroyed. The incredible success of smallpox vaccination in the 18th century showed that prevention of infectious diseases was possible, but it was over 80 years before the next successful vaccines were developed. Again, without knowing the nature of the causative microbe, Pasteur developed a vaccine against rabies, and while it was still undergoing tests in animals, he was persuaded to use it on a young boy, Joseph Meister, who had been severely savaged by a rabid dog. It saved the boy's life, and this success not only made Pasteur famous throughout Europe, but gave a boost to vaccine research and production. Pasteur discovered that bacteria, weakened by prolonged growth in the laboratory, often proved ideal vaccines, as they lost their ability to cause disease but still induced immunity. As more and more microbes responsible for acute infectious diseases were isolated during the late 19th and early 20th centuries, vaccine development became a priority. Now vaccination is recognized as the most cost-effective disease prevention strategy, and virtually all children in industrialized countries are routinely vaccinated against TB, tetanus, diphtheria, pertussis, mumps, rubella, measles, and polio, and many of these diseases are fading into memory. Newer vaccines against killers like yellow fever, hepatitis B, pneumococcal pneumonia, and rotavirus are now available, and WHO are set on sending diseases such as measles, polio, rabies, leprosy, and hepatitis B to follow smallpox into oblivion. The discovery of antibiotics. Before the antibiotic era, some infectious diseases could be prevented with vaccines, but none could be cured. So when antimicrobial drugs arrived on the scene, they seemed like a miracle cure. The sulfonamides, the first drugs with antibacterial activity, were discovered in 1932. After testing hundreds of different compounds, Gerhard Domach, a medical researcher at the Bayer Research Laboratories in Germany, found Prontosil, a chemical dye, which could cure a variety of hitherto lethal bacterial infections. By 1937, more active derivatives of Prontosil, the sulfonamides, were available, and among the microbes sensitive to the drugs was Streptococcus, the bacterium responsible for common infections such as scarlet fever, cellulitis, puerperal fever, and post-operative wound infections. Domach was awarded the Nobel Prize for his work in 1939, but as Hitler prohibited any German national from accepting the prize, he had to wait until the Second World War was over before collecting his award. The next landmark discovery was penicillin, and with a much broader range of antibacterial activity than sulfonamides, the drug was released in time to save the lives of thousands of soldiers wounded in the Second World War. Its discovery heralded the antibiotic era. Now, just a few tablets could cure killers like pneumonia, meningitis, and diphtheria, and under antibiotic cover, surgical techniques became more radical and invasive as well as safer. The history of penicillin, from its discovery and purification through to full-scale production, is one of triumph, but also of conflict between the major players. The Scottish doctor, Sir Alexander Fleming, was the first to notice the antibacterial properties of the mold, Penicillium notatum, although the way he made the discovery was somewhat serendipitous. During the First World War, Fleming worked in battlefield hospitals on the Western Front, where every day he could only look on helplessly while thousands of young soldiers died from wound infections. This experience influenced his choice of research, and by the time of his landmark discovery, he had already made his name by isolating the weak antibacterial enzyme, lysozyme, part of the body's natural defenses against invading bacteria. By all accounts, Fleming was the archetypal professor, clever but forgetful and highly disorganized. His research laboratory at St. Mary's Hospital, London, was always a mess, but on one particular occasion in 1928, we can forgive him. He returned from holiday to find some forgotten bacterial culture plates overrun with mold, but as he was discarding them, he noticed a clear zone round some fungal colonies where the bacterial growth was inhibited. Interested, he identified the mold as a new member of the Penicillium family and set about extracting the antibacterial substance it produced. He called this penicillin and published his findings the following year. But the publication attracted little interest, and as penicillin was difficult to purify, Fleming had very small quantities to work with. However, in the same year, he tried treating a few patients with infections, but had little success, until one of his laboratory assistants, Dr. K.B. Rogers, developed a pneumococcal eye infection just days before he was due to compete in a rifle shooting competition, and Fleming was persuaded to try again. With penicillin, the infection cleared up rapidly, and Rogers was clear-sighted for the match. But for some reason, Fleming did not pursue this potentially important result. In 1932, Dr. Cecil G. Payne, a pathologist from Sheffield Royal Infirmary, who had trained at St. Mary's Hospital, also succeeded in treating eye infections by irrigating the eye with the juice from Fleming's mold. Among his successes were two newborn babies with gonococcal conjunctivitis, and a colliery manager with a penetrating injury of the right eye. He developed a pneumococcal infection in the eye, so the desperately needed operation to remove the foreign body could not be carried out. Payne succeeded in curing the infection with penicillin, and the eye was saved. But still Fleming held back. He needed a professional chemist to purify enough penicillin for full-scale clinical trials, and when he could not find anyone willing to undertake the project, he lost interest, preferring to work on lysozyme. Then, in 1938, entered Howard Florey, a bright young Australian-born doctor who headed a large research team at the Sir William Dunn School of Pathology in Oxford. He and his co-worker, the equally bright biochemist Ernst Chain, a Jewish refugee from Hitler's Germany, decided to have a go at purifying penicillin. They had succeeded in producing enough of the drug for animal testing by 1940, and against the backdrop of war in Europe and the ever-present threat of Hitler's invasion of Britain, they performed experiments in mice that showed just how powerful the drug could be. Now they believed they had a vitally important drug in the making, and while the flotilla of assorted craft rescued the remains of the shattered British army from the beaches of Dunkirk, the team met to plan for every eventuality. Flurry, Chain, and others secreted P. notatum spores in the lining of their coats so that in the event of a German invasion and the destruction of the Oxford laboratory, they could start up again elsewhere. Fortunately, invasion was averted and the work continued. Fleming read of the results of Flory's animal experiments in The Lancet in August 1940 and promptly paid the Oxford team a visit. As he said, "To see what you've been doing with my old penicillin." This was the first contact between penicillin's discoverer and the Oxford team, and famously, Chain is supposed to have expressed surprise that Fleming was still alive. Flory was now seeking commercial backing for large-scale production of penicillin for clinical trials, but the climate in war-torn Europe was not conducive, and in the end he set about the task himself, virtually turning the Dunn School into a factory. Clinical trials were underway by the beginning of 1941, and the results were dramatic. The condition of all six patients treated improved with penicillin, and two were saved from almost certain death. With these encouraging results, and with America's imminent entry into the war, Flory obtained commercial backing from the U.S., and mass production quickly followed. Relations between Fleming, Flory, and Chain were not always the most friendly, and Flory was particularly unhappy when the press awarded Fleming the lion's share of the credit for the miracle cure. However, with very different characters and skills, they had each uniquely contributed to the final miracle, and in 1945 they were jointly awarded a Nobel Prize for their work. With this incredible achievement, all seemed set to conquer bacteria. Hundreds of new antibiotics were discovered so that the whole spectrum of bacterial infections could now be cured. Some confidently predicted the demise of infectious disease microbes that had been the scourge of mankind since the advent of agriculture some 10,000 years ago, but it was not to be. With the indiscriminate overuse of antibiotics, microbes have fought back. Antibiotic-resistant bacteria like methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, MRSA, MRSA, and M. tuberculosis have emerged, and we are running out of options. As we shall see in the next chapter, people are again dying of infections that only a decade ago were easily treatable. 8. The Fight Back. Throughout history, microbes undoubtedly had the upper hand, but by the mid-20th century, our fight back was well underway, and for a time it really seemed as if killer epidemics could be conquered at last. But no sooner had the much-quoted United States Surgeon General, William Stewart, declared that we can now close the book on infectious diseases in 1967, than we began to see new and sometimes lethal microbes emerging. Since then, they have hit us at the rate of around once a year, and now the frequency is increasing, a scenario that seems to mirror events of 10,000 years ago, when animal domestication prompted a spate of new human infections. And the reasons today are broadly the same as they were then, environmental changes that bring us into contact with new microbes, which are then spread by travellers. The major emerging microbe threats today are the unrelenting global spread of HIV, the looming spectre of microbial drug resistance, and the frightening possibility of a mutated H5N1 bird flu causing a human pandemic. but in the post-genome era, we are no longer battling in ignorance against an unknown enemy. In this chapter, we look at the reasons behind the increasing numbers of emerging microbes and ask whether, with all our accumulated scientific knowledge, we are better prepared to fight them than our ancestors were. Despite all the ups and downs of our battle with microbes, the fact remains that Homo sapiens is the most successful species that ever roamed the planet. With our complex brains, capable of detailed forward planning and highly sophisticated speech communication, we have succeeded in adapting to life in almost every environmental niche on the Earth's surface. And despite the ravages of natural disasters, wars, and killer microbes, our population has grown steadily so that we now dominate life on Earth. The world's population has roughly doubled every 500 years since the beginning of the Christian era, when it stood at some 300 million. It reached 1 billion by 1800 and 1.6 billion by 1900, but the most dramatic increase occurred very recently. During the 20th century, average life expectancy doubled, and the population rose fourfold. Now there are well over 6 billion people in the world, and 50% of us live in cities. The result of this unprecedented population explosion is already apparent. We live in a world where our fast-disappearing natural jungles are being replaced by rapidly expanding concrete ones. The world's largest city is Tokyo, with an incredible 34 million inhabitants. But now most of our huge metropolises are in the developing world, topped by Mexico City, home to over 20 million. And since our population is predicted to reach 8 to 9 billion by 2050 and 9 to 10 billion by the end of the 21st century, this growth of towns and cities is likely to continue unabated. The amazing human success story comes at a high price. Whereas all other species are controlled by their environment, we now control ours. So what sort of a job are we making of it? In a world of a finite size with limited resources, these stark population statistics are alarming. The situation we have created is not sustainable for the future. Our burgeoning population, combined with human greed, underlies most of our current global problems. The energy crisis, the lack of clean water, air, sea, and land pollution, plant and animal extinctions with the loss of biodiversity, the hole in the ozone layer, and global warming. And in addition to this catalogue of potential disasters, overpopulation is key to the rise in emerging microbes. In an overcrowded world, we are always pushing against the margins of civilization. Whether in search of food, work, shelter, or merely an exciting challenge, we invade new environments, disrupting ecosystems that have remained unchanged for thousands of years. Be it rainforests destroyed, rivers dammed, or wild animals trapped, each is a niche for microbes we know little about, some of which have the potential to infect and even kill us. A quick glance at a list of our recently emerging microbes shows that most were first acquired from wild animals. We have seen how SARS emerged in Guangdong province, where people like to select their meat live from wet markets, and tests show that some local farmers and market traders have met the SARS virus before. So the virus had clearly made the transition from animal to man on several previous occasions. Who knows when it or another like it will do so again? The ecosystem of the tropical rainforest is the most diverse in the world, and it is teeming with deadly microbes. For centuries, the yellow fever virus and malaria parasite prevented us from conquering the African jungle, and there are many more microbes lurking, ready to pounce on anyone who interferes with its delicate balance. One famous example is the deadly Ebola virus, renowned for its explosive epidemics in remote tropical settings. Its natural animal host is still unknown, and it is imperative that we find it and stop these outbreaks, because each new one gives the virus an opportunity to evolve more efficient ways of spreading between people and infecting a larger population. HIV-1 is another virus that emerged from the rainforests of Africa, where it jumped from the chimpanzee subspecies Pan troglodyte troglodytes, which carries it as a silent infection. These large primates live in Central Africa, but they have almost been driven to extinction by our destruction of their habitat and our desire for bushmeat. It is easy to see how a virus in chimp's blood could transfer to a human during the bloody process of killing and butchering such an animal, and analysis of banks of stored African blood samples shows that HIV-1 has transferred to humans on several occasions before the 1930s, although it did not spread significantly between humans until the 1970s. With tourists now demanding the bushmeat experience and some 1 to 5 million metric tons of it consumed every year in the Congo alone, it is not surprising that scientists have recently turned up evidence of several other primate viruses that have, on occasions, jumped to humans. It is probably only a matter of time before one of these succeeds in spreading between humans and causes a new epidemic. But the bushmeat trade is not the only cause for concern. International trade in live wild animals for agriculture, scientific experimentation, or pets is now a multi-billion dollar industry. Germany experienced the first outbreak of Marburg fever caused by an Ebola-like hemorrhagic fever virus, which arrived in 1967 in a consignment of African green monkeys from Uganda and infected 31 laboratory workers, killing 7 of them. More recently, a monkeypox outbreak in the U.S. began when the virus was imported from Ghana along with Gambian giant rats for the exotic pet market. The virus transferred to prairie dogs housed in the same pet shop as the rats and jumped from there to their owners. The chain of infection was only terminated after the microbe had infected 71 people. And there are reports that farmed crocodiles in Papua New Guinea, fed on wild pig meat, have developed trichinella, a life-threatening worm that they could easily pass on to their keepers. Who knows what else might be hiding just around the corner? Poverty. It is glaringly obvious from a glance at the figures that poverty is the major cause of microbe-related deaths. On a worldwide scale, microbes are still major killers, accounting for 1 in 3 of all deaths. But the huge discrepancy in the death rates between rich and poor nations reveals the stark reality. Whereas only 1 to 2% of all deaths in the West are caused by microbes, this figure rises to over 50% in the poorest nations of the world, and it is in these highly microbe-infected areas where over 95% of the global deaths from infections occur. Most of the 17 million killed by microbes each year are children in developing countries where the link with poverty is clear. It is the poor who are malnourished, live in filthy, overcrowded urban slums, and go without clean drinking water or sewage disposal, and therefore, they are the ones who fall prey to the killer microbes. HIV, malaria, TB, respiratory infections and diarrheal diseases like cholera, typhoid and rotavirus. All eminently preventable and treatable given the resources. The spread of HIV is an excellent example of how microbes exploit the poor, striking at the most disadvantaged in the community. The virus emerged in Central Africa and spread silently throughout the continent in the 1970s, given a head start by its long, silent incubation period, and aided by despotic leaders, corrupt governments, civil wars, tribal conflicts, droughts and famines. Carried by undisciplined armies and terrorists, the virus infiltrated city slums, infected commercial sex workers, was picked up by migrant workers, and passed on to their wives and families. While malnutrition accelerated the onset of AIDS, breakdown of healthcare services in the political turmoil of Africa excluded any possibility of medical support for the millions in need. Now we are living through the worst pandemic the world has ever known, with 40 million living with HIV, 25 million already dead, and around 10,000 dying daily, the equivalent of over 3 9/11 disasters every 24 hours. A third of people living in sub-Saharan African cities are HIV infected, and while highly active antiretroviral therapy, HAART, has converted this lethal disease into a manageable chronic infection in the West, presently only a tiny proportion of Africans living with HIV receive this treatment. For most, there is no hope of obtaining the drugs vital for keeping them alive. The dynamics of HIV in Africa reflects its mode of spread. As the virus is sexually transmitted, gender inequalities mean that women are particularly vulnerable. In general, they are poorer and less well-educated than their male counterparts, and are often powerless to choose or restrict their sexual partners, or to insist on condom use. Indeed, many are forced to exchange sex for essentials like food, shelter, and schooling. Now, one in four African women are HIV infected by the age of 22 years, compared to one in 14 men of the same age, and women account for 60% of all those living with HIV. Over 90% of HIV-positive women in Africa are mothers, and the virus has created 15 million orphans worldwide, 12 million of them in sub-Saharan Africa. These children are bearing the burden of the HIV pandemic. They miss school to care for their sick mothers or to earn the family income. The virus has not only deprived them of their parents, but their childhood and their education as well. Travel. All through history, we have seen how travelers spread microbes, first causing the merger of discrete infectious disease pools in the Old World, then spearheading their invasion of the New World, and finally disseminating microbes to all the world's most isolated communities. Generally speaking, epidemics can only move as fast as humans can travel. So in the days when commercial goods were carried on horse or camelback along ancient trade routes, and wind-powered galleys sailed from port to port, progress was slow. Many potential human microbes must have died out along the way through lack of susceptible victims to sustain their chain of infection. But when the transport revolution of the 19th and 20th centuries speeded things up, microbes also benefited, spreading further and faster than ever before. This is nicely illustrated by the shrinking of travel time between the UK and Australia, which telescoped from a whole year by sailing ship in the 18th century to 100 days by clipper in the early 19th century to 50 days by steamer at the beginning of the 20th century. This significantly increased the chance of travelers spawning an epidemic like measles, which, with an incubation period of 14 days, had to pass through a chain of six susceptible people on board a clipper to reach Australia in the 19th century, but only three when travelling by steamer in the early 20th. The contraction of travel time was felt particularly in small islands like Fiji and Iceland, where the sparse population relied on shipping links for vital supplies. Too small to sustain endemic microbes themselves, epidemics arrived by sea, and their frequency increased as travelling time decreased. But the effect of advances in shipping on microbe spread was negligible compared to the impact air travel had in the 20th century. This collapsed geographical space so drastically that now we can get from virtually any large city in the world